Accession number 27083, reel 59.
So, Henry, you landed on and was greeted by the Spanish...
Greeted by the Spanish admiral, who turned out to be a charming man, spoke good English, and I hardly spoke a word of Spanish. He was a bit surprised to see me in the front seat, I think, but that was all right. And he took me up to the bridge, where I think on the admiral's bridge he laid on a champagne lunch. Well, because I wanted to fly back afterwards, I wasn't prepared to drink champagne. So the first pilot drank my ration of champagne with great aplomb, and I had a soft drink. And I'm glad to say we did find our way out afterwards. They couldn't have been more hospitable, and it was a very worthwhile visit altogether.
What made it worthwhile?
The evident rapport at all levels that you achieved, if that doesn't sound boastful, in the course of it. You can tell. It's rather like entering a friendly house or an unfriendly house. And you pick up an atmosphere pretty soon after arrival. And that atmosphere, if it's a good one, will almost certainly develop by the time you leave. If it's a bad one, you might, if you're lucky, but seldom, I think, correct it into being an almost good one, but with shortcomings and so forth. And this just went with a swing. And one was able, usually through an interpreter, to talk to the people, and quite freely about anything under the sun. And you were established. The only real word is rapport, I think. This is very important.
So once again, it's a question of meeting and greeting, pressing the flesh, of which
yes.
These very senior jobs seem to have that almost as their most important function.
Well, I think it is very important. And I had always held that view and was determined when I got to a senior position to implement it. And, for example, with my American opposite number or numbers, if they changed, I made a point of going over and spending at least 24 hours with the new chap, whether he liked it or not. I then knew I was able to size him up. Hopefully you would have established something of a relationship even in that short time. And then if a crisis occurred, and he came up with a signal that appeared to you to be stupid, you were much better placed to realize that he wasn't the sort of guy who would make a stupid signal, or else that he was, if he went that way. And you therefore knew whether to challenge the butts or not. This was essential, really, in terms of top-level dealings. Well, now my next visit, and I'm not sure that I'm taking all these in chronological order, but it doesn't really matter. I had been quite impressed by the Chinese defense attaché in London. And I was aware of the fact that no First Sea Lord for I don't know how many years, I think that century, had paid a visit to China. Hong Kong, yes, but it wasn't Chinese then. Or it was, but it was, you know, not really. The Chief of Defense Staff, Neil Cameron, had paid a visit to China. I don't think he'd enjoyed it much. And the scurrilous, I suppose, certainly our scurrilous papers, claimed to have got it from the Chinese media, had referred to him as the drunken hare. I don't know whether you remember that, but
I don't.
Somehow it didn't seem to have struck a very warm bell. So I thought that, and I realized that the importance of China was on the up rather than on the down, and I think I got that right. And I negotiated to pay a formal visit to China. In the event, I had to get hold of the defense attaché and explain exactly what was happening to him, with pulling no punches at all, because the state of impending cuts and defense review stuff had degenerated to such that I couldn't really leave Whitehall responsibly. And so I got over the attaché and drummed it into him that I wasn't going to be able to go as the visit had been scheduled. And I hoped that this would be interpreted by the Chinese authorities as being a postponement to a time yet to be negotiated, but later on, say 6 months, 8 months, or whatever, and not a cancellation. And so it came about. And so, without filling in the chronology, I'll cover the visit when it did come about. They had sent the vice chief of the naval staff on a visit to England with a very small staff, and I'd met him. He wasn't really, I think he was just coming to dust over their embassy rather than to have a more formal visit, but I had met him and I'd been to dinner with him, and that was a fairly stressful affair, because you went in and you were greeted by your host, and you were then greeted by introduced to all the men, and then you realized that all the women were in a separate line, quite apart, and you weren't introduced to them, but there they were. And then when you moved into dinner, you sat with the men, and the women sat separately, and it was all quite tricky stuff. And again, you went in strict rigidity of separation during the time spent after dinner, and so on.
Did you ever get to meet the women at all?
Well, yes, I just walked across, and but it wasn't quite the same, and it's, you wondered if you were committing an appalling bêtise by doing so. Anyway, the time ran out, and off I went to China. I can't remember if I went to other countries first. I think I may have done, because it was a long way off, and so forth. We flew into, again I took my naval assistant, which I normally did, and we flew into to Peking, Beijing, and I was put up in a so-called guest house, which was like a mini palace. It was large, it was very well furnished, but of course I was only there for breakfast, and I was about to say for a bath before dinner. I never had a bath before dinner in the whole of my 6-day visit. There wasn't time, and you were shuffled from one thing to another thing to another thing. And I never had a bath before midnight, when the day's business was over. And it was quite a strain. In the course of those 6 days, I attended 11 banquets, which was every lunch at every dinner, except for the last lunch, which was just before I flew out. And they were quite something. No banquet was less than 13, 14 courses. They had laid it on in a big way, what they regarded as particular delicacies. I found so nauseating that you could hardly put them in your mouth. I struggle through, and I'm not very adept at using chopsticks, nor am I very well practiced, but I struggle through with chopsticks the whole time. And the sort of things I'm talking about was a typical entree was what looked like what we would call coleslaw. It was nothing to do with coleslaw, in fact. It was shredded jellyfish. It was their practice for the host to help you from the multitude of dishes around the table, a bit of each, all of which he'd put into your bowl. And it wasn't done for you to refuse anything. The only saving clause was you didn't have to eat it all. So once it was in your bowl, you could leave it in your bowl, but you didn't want to make this too obvious. Another thing was, I'm trying to think what it was called now. We didn't have shark's fin soup, which I detest. That was too plebeian, that was too ordinary. We never had that at all. They had, oh yes, octopus stomach was a great delicacy. And the mere name, even now, causes my gorge to twitch. And the octopus stomach was cut up into strips, which looked rather like office rubber bands, about that width, the tough ones. And I tentatively put, having at last captured one of these things into my mouth, and I chewed and I chewed and I chewed, and I could make no impression on it at all. Absolutely none. And so under pretext of having a coughing fit or a sneezing fit or something, I put it out into my handkerchief and got rid of it. Then they had, what else did they have? I won't go on. These were, to them, great delicacies, and so it was a great honor to have been treated to such stuff. But you went on, and you went on, and you went on. They made their speeches throughout the meal, not piled up at the end. And the norm was for your host, who almost certainly did not speak English, to sit next but one from you, with an interpreter in between. And by the luck of the Lord, the interpreter that I had got to know was a young army captain, and I got to know a bit during the vice chief's visit to UK previously, and he was a nice guy. He spoke fluent English, highly intelligent, and he acted as my interpreter, and we'd got a sort of a thing between us going, so that was good. Then
the question I must ask is, China is right outside Britain's sphere of influence, I would have thought.
Yep.
The east of Syria withdrawal, etc., etc. There is Hong Kong, but it's outside the sphere. What's the point of, what was the reason for going to China all that distance?
Well, this was
to engage in an eating company.
Well, self-imposed, really. I felt that China was on the ascendancy, that she'd been left out, leaving aside the politics of communism versus non and that sort of thing, She'd been left out of it totally for far too long, and that it was about time somebody did something about it. Now, you could say that that wasn't my business, but I thought that I had the ability to strike a blow for better relations, so to speak, and I took it. I'll come back to that a bit when I have a few remarks to make on what I think the value of my visit actually was.
Okay.
Now, how did I... Well, I was describing these meals. And the form was that your host would get up at a certain stage and he'd make a speech. And he'd end with drinking your health, and everybody stood up. And I had been briefed by the British Defence Attaché, who was a brigadier, that there were three things that that I would be invited to drink. In no special order, there was quite good, quite strong, but quite good beer. There was rice wine, and there was Moutai, which was the sort of Chinese equivalent of schnapps, but nowhere near as strong. Well, I may have exaggerated that, not as strong, but nevertheless quite strong. And it had a very distinctive taste. I'd had this in the Chinese embassy in London, and I noticed that their vice chief did not have it. And rather like schnapps, they were inclined to say things like, you know, one is all right, and two is, I'm not quite the man you were, and three, you're definitely unwell, and four, you're blinded for life, sort of thing. But they did not down it in one, like the Russians tended to with their vodka. You only had to put it to your lips and as a token thing. However, after you had made your return speech and given the toast to your host, you were expected to go around each one of the, it varied in number, 8, 10 circular tables of eight, and solemnly toast every member at that table, which is why you didn't knock it back. It was quite a strain, and you got back to your guest house at about midnight in time for a bath and a crash. The British ambassador was away on leave, and so politically I was barreled by the chargé d'affaires, nice man, can't remember his name, and I think on the first day we had a formal meeting as between the two navies, so to speak. Now, the Chinese have a system whereby in military ranks, at any rate, I can't quote for others, I think it goes through the political ranks as well, you never retire from office. Your only means of retirement is to be bumped off or you die. And my proper opposite number, the Chief of Naval Staff, had, I don't know how many, strokes, had Alzheimer's, you name it, he was a cabbage. But he remained Chief of the Chinese Naval Staff. Hence the Vice Chief's visit to England, and it was the Vice Chief who was really the top cat. And I offered to go along to his bedside for the chief, and even perhaps through an interpreter, exchange a few words, and I was told that wasn't on at all. I never did. The meeting took place in some big building in Peking. I suppose the equivalent of their Minister of Defence. And it consisted of a long table, and the Chinese sat on one side and the Brits sat on the other. And by the Brits, I mean myself, my naval assistant, the chargé d'affaires, and there were a couple of the chargé's staff. And that was it. The agenda, which had been cleared beforehand, both sides, was so simple, so basic, as to be bordering on the insulting. I mean, the sort of thing that you could have handed to a cadet after his first term at Dartmouth, and he would have been perfectly competent to have gone through various things. And I made a great mistake. This was all set out like any other agenda. And you had this on the table in front of you with a blotting pad and that sort of thing. And I had a few briefs, but it was so straightforward and dead simple. You didn't need a brief. You hardly needed to. You just had to sort of glance at the agenda and then say something. And you had to speak slowly, of course, because it had to be translated by an interpreter and so on. And the mistake I made was that I didn't look at my briefs. And because I hadn't looked at my briefs, when it came to their turn, and we took it in turns, and when it came to their turn to speak, they felt that they couldn't look at their briefs, otherwise they'd lose face. And they hadn't the foggiest idea what they were talking about. Not the remotest. And it was extraordinary. And so frankly, the meeting per se, which would never have achieved anything anywhere, but it wasn't even a good example. It must have gone on for a couple of hours. It didn't even establish a particularly close rapport. It didn't establish anything. So that was that. Well, I was taken round and shown the sights. I saw the Summer Palace, I saw the Ming tombs, all good stuff, and frightfully good for my education, and would have been very enjoyable if any I could have sauntered about with my wife. But those weren't the circumstances. And then the program had been arranged entirely by them. I was taken up to, I can't remember the name of the place now, but it was their equivalent of Dartmouth. It was the Naval Training College. Darlang or Darliang or some such, I haven't got the name quite right, I don't think. And I flew up in one of their aircraft. No question of my taking the controls there. And it was a sweltering hot day. And I was taken around this establishment. I was met, which again is typical of their habits. You were never met by your opposite number. You were always met by one down. And so I wasn't met by the head of the establishment. I was met by the number two. Later you met the head, but he wasn't there to greet you, as it were. And that was the way they did their business. They'd ask me why, but it was their custom. Well, that was no skin off my nose. And we played it accordingly. And I wandered around this place throughout a very long morning, and I was shown classrooms. I never actually came across another human being. Extraordinary. I was taken around by a small team of three or four. But you never, when you entered a new block, you didn't see or meet anybody. And so on. And the equipment that you saw was antediluvian. I'm talking now of the back end of 81, I think. And the equipment was on a par with what had just been scrounged at Dartmouth in the early part of 1939. And that shook me. In due course, we foregathered for lunch. Again, a banquet. Again, 13, 14 courses. again speeches. Prior to it, we sat in serried rows, one row of Chinese, one row, rather shorter row, of Brits, in huge leather armchairs, and we just poured down soft drinks because it was very, very hot. And we staggered through lunch, quite unremarkable, and we made speeches and all that stuff. And we, towards the end of lunch, we were due to pull out at 2 o'clock or so and fly down to Shanghai. But towards the end of lunch, word came through of an approaching typhoon. And so the flight was postponed. It was thought that the typhoon would pass safely through, but it might take 4 to 6 hours to do so. So we were left with an entirely, from both points of view, an entirely unprogrammed, longish afternoon to waste. And we went back to the anteroom and we sank into our armchairs and so forth. And I turned to the interpreter and through him to the boss and said that what I would really like to do would be to wander about the playing fields, because I was told that they spent their afternoon in recreation, wander about their playing fields and down to where they had a bit of river or something and they had boats on it, and talk to the cadets, none of whom had I met. And that created a bit of a stir, and a couple of guys left the room, and we sat there drinking our lemonade, and we were awash with lemonade by then, and looking at each other, and one had to keep the conversation going somehow, and to this day I don't know how we did it, but we did. And then a chap came in and said, not quite what I had asked for, but he had assembled the cadets in two classrooms, and I would be taken along to talk to them. And they had divided the cadets into two halves. And whether they normally did this, I don't know. One half was entirely uneducated. They were up from the ranks. And they really knew nothing about anything. And the other half had been drawn straight from the civilian population and had a significantly better, more than just a smattering, of education. And it was the former that I spoke to first. And I exchanged a few compliments and so forth. And then I started to ask a few questions. And got practically no response at all. And after a bit, I packed it in and went to an entirely different room where I spoke to the next lot. And I was wondering how we were going to get on with this. And it was all very depressing. But in fact, they were much more sparky. And they did ask some questions. And one rather prolonged the answers, all through an interpreter. And so forth. And that was that. And so the afternoon passed, and down I went to Shanghai. And the Shanghai was the base for the South China, or was it East China? South China, I think, South China Sea Fleet, which was the main fleet. And the fleet commander had been summoned to come up to Peking to attend the meeting that I had, the formal meeting, and he hadn't liked being summoned up there at all. And he was a patently nasty bit of work. He was dour, he was anti, he was everything, and just the sort of person that you would say, golly, wouldn't care to meet him on a dark night. And he was to be my host. Well, we got down to Shanghai. I can't remember. We must have spent the night doing something. There was probably another banquet, I suppose. And then next day I think was Sunday. Made no odds to them at all. And they had a good cross-section of the fleet alongside. And you were driven down to the dockyard. And you got out of the car at the dockyard main gate. And they had they'd lined the route from there on to the gangway leading into the first ship. And the first ship was the end ship at the furthest end. So it was a long, long, straight avenue, lined both sides by sailors and some officers. And there was a guard somewhere. And you were expected to walk down the middle, and you were supposed to clap your hands, in uniform, of course. And you felt an absolute Charlie doing so. But that was the drill, so I did the Chinese drill. And they clapped back. And I suppose you could say that this was a method of dumb communication, up to a point, but it was pretty dumb. Well, I went on board the first ship, and I was shown round. These were all ex-Russians. And I chatted up various people, and as far as I could, through the interpreter. And I found myself at the back of the bridge.